Hello and welcome to the New Books in History podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Krzysztof Odyniec, and today we're talking with Pekka Hämäläinen about his book, The Comanche Empire. Professor Hämäläinen is Rhodes Professor at the University of Oxford, specializing in early and 19th century North American history, especially in indigenous, colonial, imperial borderlands, and environmental history, all topics that invite comparative discussion and a global view. Professor Hämäläinen is author also of When Disease Makes History, Epidemics and Great Historical Turning Points, which was published in 2006, and now The Comanche Empire, which was published in 2009 and won a number of awards, including the Bancroft Prize. So the book is already a few years old, but I think it's certainly a new book in history because the way it views indigenous history and the Comanche Empire is new, and it has changed a lot of the discussion in classrooms and historical and historiographic circles all around the world. So I'm very pleased to have Pekka Hämäläinen on the podcast today. And would you please, sir, tell us about the Comanche Empire, both the early modern polity and the book itself?
Happy to. So what would you like to know?
Well, I think, how did you come to see this empire that we did not see in the past? And I come to you from a 16th century Spanish Empire perspective. So my view, you know, and certainly as an undergraduate and as a secondary school student in my whole life, is that here the Europeans were carving up the planet. And you can see on the map, you know, this is the red area that belongs to Spain, and this is the blue area that belongs to France. And somewhere in there are indigenous peoples, which you have said, you know, were previously viewed as speed bumps on the way to European domination of the planet, but not so. The story is very different. I think maybe you said in a recent talk at Nottingham that it was a new indigenous history, or I may have the term incorrectly, but that this perspective, this the agency and the point of view of an empire we didn't see because it wasn't written on these jigsaw puzzle European maps, which you call a fiction. How did you find it? How did you see it?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I was always, like you, you know, very suspicious about these traditional maps with these color-coded blocks of territory and Indians having no space, actually, and no presence in those maps. So I was always, you know, troubled by these cartographic tradition, but you know, really, you know, the Comanche Empire, I really found it was kind of a genuine discovery in a way. You know, I was doing a very different project initially, a history of all the Plains Indians, sort of a kind of a ridiculous project in a way, because it included more than 30 Plains Indian tribes. And doing the research, eventually I came to the Comanches, and I just realized there was something missing. There was a kind of sense that there was a gap, some gap in the historiography, that I pretty quickly developed a sense that they were much more powerful than most historians had realized. And I just dropped the larger project of this comprehensive history of all Plains Indians and just focused on Comanches, and wrote one article which focused on trade. That was the blind spot I found in the historiography, and published something on it, and then kept going, and that it became then the Comanche Empire was first my dissertation, and then a couple of years later, it became the book.
The book is a pleasure to read on many levels. And one thing I love how you did is you write the narrative, but there's also the footnotes. And so you can read it turning page after page about the story. This happened here, this happened there. And then I wonder, how does he know that? And I would flip frequently back and see, here's a deposition of one Spanish official, or here's a report of a friar. Are the sources you have found chiefly European sources that then you piece together and find a narrative that tells you about, you know, the Comanche view of trade or Comanche view of raiding and so on? Or were you able to find other kinds of indigenous sources? And then you talk in your introduction about the methods of upstreaming, sidestreaming, and a stereoscopic historiography. Can you describe how you found it and how you found the story you could tell?
Yeah, I think in some ways it was really, you know, kind of a shift of perspective. That was the methodological breakthrough I had. So I think, you know, most of the sources are actually known. I don't think I found maybe a couple of new sources, but most of the sources were very well known to historians. But what I did, it was sort of looking things differently. So I think, you know, many traditionally native histories sort of looked from colonial frontiers inward, you know, sort of seeing things through the colonist eyes. And in a very simple way, I sort of just did the reverse. And I placed myself sort of metaphorically speaking in the center of Comanche land, Comancheria, and sort of took like a 360 degree view from Comancheria outward and seeing, you know, what does New Mexico, what does Texas, what does Louisiana, the French colonialism, how do they fit into this Comanche world, and trying to look things from Comanche point of view. And suddenly, you know, when I did that, I started to see patterns. The first patterns were trade, how Comancheria, this sort of traditionally considered like a almost a blind spot on a map, you know, this very marginalized region, actually suddenly emerged as this commercial hub. And the same happened with warfare, raiding, and so and diplomacy, and so forth and so forth. So it was really kind of a systematic inspection of the American West from Comancheria outward.
And what kind of records did the Comanches have? The interesting thing is that it doesn't resemble a European polity, and that there's no architecture, there's no ruins. I presume there's no archive, right? How do you do it? How do you get there?
Yeah, the Comanche sources are quite limited, and the Comanches, you know, some anthropologists believe the Comanches were quite reluctant to speak to anthropologists in the late 19th century and early 20th century when the anthropologists conduct systematic research in different reservations. And the Comanches were sort of, they kept their cards pretty close to their chest. So we don't have much anthropological material on Comanches. We have enough, but not huge amounts. And the Comanches don't have really, you know, rich records like, for instance, the Lakota Sioux have, which is their wind accounts. So those kinds of sources are not available. So it's mostly European sources, like you mentioned in the beginning, you know, just reading the European sources through kind of an ethnographic filter, trying to understand what's happening, you know, what are the events and key events, and how Comanches may have understood them, and what they meant to the Comanches. So it's really a kind of a way of reading European sources against the grain. Luckily, there were quite a few traders, because the Comanches became, a very, very powerful commercial nation. So there were a lot of visitors, a lot of Spanish officials, Spanish explorers, American explorers, American traders visiting the Comanches and reporting what they saw in Comanche land and Comanche villages, and how the Comanches function as a society, and so forth and so forth. So those sources were very, very, you know, helpful for me. So luckily we had this kind of little bit of insider view, you know, a view from within, although always through European eyes.
Yes, and I suppose because of the trade is the place to begin. Trade is less political, perhaps, than anything else. So one remarkable theme in your book is how the Comanche could alternate between trading and raiding, or violence and diplomacy, all at the same time, and how both of those were aspects of diplomacy, and how often the Comanche could play the Spanish against the French or the other American Indian tribes in the region. Tell us a bit about the amazing world of trade that you discovered.
Well, the core of the trade is horses. So the Comanches became this specialized pastoralist society. You know, we often think of them as a typical, you know, hunter gatherers, but they really became a sort of a pastoral society, pastoral power. You know, with massive horse herds, and that was the foundation, sort of the economic foundation of the empire and the economic foundation of the trading system, whose tentacles sort of expanded far to the north, almost to the Canadian border, far to the east towards Louisiana, and far to the west on the towards the Rocky Mountains. So the Comanches had massive numbers of horses and surplus horses they could exchange for all the things they needed, which is mostly guns, metal, iron, ammunition, lead, powder, and so forth and so forth. They also traded buffalo ropes, but that wasn't essential in my view as the horse trade, because the Comanches had there was a sort of ecological fault line. Because the winters get increasingly harsher from south to north, as can be expected, which meant that the horse racing was much more difficult the further north you got on the Great Plains. So there was horse racing was very, very difficult in the north, and the northern plains were kind of a deficit region where the Comanches could always find healthy, steady markets for their horses, and then get in return guns, powder, and other manufactured goods that helped sort of prop up their power and their empire in the Southwest.
And try as they might, the Europeans who would like to limit Indian access to gunpowder and firearms could not because of this multilateral trade network. So wherever the Spanish tried to keep the Indians from having guns, they would just go get them from the French and so on.
Absolutely, yes. And these chains, like I said, you know, like you mentioned, you know, they extend all the way back to St. Lawrence Valley and all the way to the East Coast.
So what about these fairs? That to me reminds me of medieval European history, where you go to the fair in Champagne or something like that. Here you had the fairs of Pecos and Taos. What are these places, and what was it like to be at the fair in the American Southwest in the 18th century?
Yeah, I mean they're quite well. They are, first of all, they are multi-ethnic. So you would have the Spanish. You would have Spanish officials. You would have Spanish priests, and you would have Pueblo Indians, and maybe Ute Indians from the Rocky Mountains, and then you would have the Comanche embassies coming in from the plains and bringing all kinds of goods to trade, not only horses, you know, and not only bison ropes, but also slaves, you know, captured elsewhere. So one of the sort of essential threats of these fairs was this trading captives and slaves, which clearly made, obviously made these sort of a very, very intensely emotionally charged occasions with hard bargaining, with a lot of emotions and sheer human drama. I mean, these trade centers were the sort of the nerve centers of the colonial and indigenous economies, and absolutely central to both. Neither the colonists nor the Comanches could have really survived as political entities without these fairs. So the fairs sort of pull these two very different societies together, but they also separate them in many fundamental ways. Because when you have things like slavery and captive trade, these are complicated issues, obviously. So there was always, you know, many, you know, sort of kind of conflicting interests, because these are such, you know, multi-ethnic affairs. And often, you know, the main challenge was to avoid violence in these emotionally charged affairs.
That's such a remarkable, I would say, very surprising revelation that I found in this book, was the use of captives and slaves as part of the political and diplomatic game. And it also mm-hmm. seems very different to me than the way I previously considered slavery in the 18th century, which was this European plantation chattel slavery around, you know, the production of sugar or coffee or tobacco and so on. But here, this is the slavery of raiding and exchange of captives. And one shocking detail that you add from this horrified priest, Fray Pedro Serrano, was the custom of Comanche to publicly rape the women they brought to market before selling them. And it's, I mean, we have this account through the eyes of a Spanish priest. So obviously it's hard to guess what is going on. You suggest that this act was to horrify the Europeans and to make them, maybe to cow them or to negotiate for their captives before this could happen to the women, or what? I guess the question is twofold. One, what do you think is going on? And two, how do you understand slavery in the Southwest, which is so different than Atlantic slavery?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, that source you mentioned, the public rape, you know, I agonized actually whether to include it in the book, because it is such a striking source and a disturbing source. But then, you know, I decided to try to understand what's behind it. And I think it's precisely what you said. The Comanches are, to me, it seems they are, through the abuse, trying to get, sort of create a moral obligation for the Spanish to buy these slaves. And it's kind of a warning, you know, if you don't, this is how it's going to be for these women. So you have to buy them. It's your moral responsibility to purchase them now. And I mean, that is my interpretation. In some ways it's a guesstimate, but it's difficult to think of another reason, really. And slavery. So it's a really interesting slave system or captivity system, because it really is it's not chattel slavery, and it's kind of a slavery where captivity shades into kinship. Very smoothly. So many of the captives lived in the Comanche households, and many of the captives, especially young boys, were adopted into Comanche families as a fully fledged members of the community. And there was as far as we know, there was no stigma of being a former slave and now a kind of a naturalized Comanche. You know, if one behaved like Comanche, one was accepted as Comanche, fully fledged Comanche. It was more about not ethnicity and not the racial background or anything like that, but behavior and understanding the culture. If you can behave like a Comanche, if you can speak like a Comanche, you can be Comanche.
Is that true for everyone, including Spanish captives, French captives?
Absolutely. I think so. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I think there's limited kind of ethnic consciousness in a way. Behavior is everything.
It makes me think of Little Big Man, the movie with Dustin mm-hmm. Hoffman, where he is adopted. I always thought that was just a fantasy, you know, a Hollywood fantasy, but not so.
Yeah, that movie was ahead of its time, definitely. One of my favorite movies. You know, I think that it's the movie that got me interested initially in Native history. I'm glad you mentioned it.
No kidding. Could you say what is a henisaro? This term that you use for is that the same thing? This slavery that becomes that slides into kinship or an adoption, yes. Or is that something else?
Yeah, no, these henisaro villages. They are mixed villages on New Mexico's eastern border and Comancheria's western border, and these are freed captives or freed slaves who are kind of ethnically ambiguous group, not entirely Spanish, not entirely Comanche, but something in between, and as such very useful for both these powerful power brokers of the region, which is the Spanish colonists and the Comanche nation or the Comanche Empire. Yeah, so their villages become sort of a conduit between the two societies, the Spanish and the Comanches, and allowing them to Comanches and Spanish to meet in their villages and conduct trade and diplomacy and so forth and so forth. I think it's a very typical borderland phenomenon, actually, in North America, where you don't really have hard, clearly defined borders until well into the late 19th century, in most cases.
And the European sources that we see in your footnotes, some of them, as I guess we would expect, are strangers in a strange world and see aliens and barbaros, and some of them become quite sophisticated. And I'm a Spanish historian mm-hmm. myself, and so my favorite character, or I should say historical figure, is this governor who is, it just escaped me. I think it's Vélez Cachupín, who sort of yes. untangles what the language of gift giving and understands how politics is personal and not institutional in a very interesting way, and his knowledge doesn't necessarily survive his tenure because the next fellow who comes along makes the same mistakes that the mm-hmm. previous fellow who came along, and he's just a remarkable figure. And can you say a bit about the ethnographic progress that the early modern Spaniard who suddenly found himself in this very new place was able to.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point, because we'll be sort of after Richard White's Middle Ground and many other books, where the French colonists have sort of become the embodiment of the perhaps broad-minded colonists who understood the native mindset and were able to forge functioning relations with the native people and sort of try to understand their worldview. And although as Richard White says, more through creative misunderstandings than understanding perfectly each other. But I think the same sort of dynamic happens is precisely like with Cachupin in the American Southwest with the Spanish and the Comanches. They try to understand one another to a degree. They do, and they make it work. But there's also a lot of misunderstandings and sort of a blind spots which can be very useful. In a way, because it allows these it's almost a safety valve in a relationship that is very 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 intense. So the mutual misunderstandings allow coexistence in a very sort of surprising, paradoxical way. It's better not to if the two sides had understood each other perfectly, the coexistence might have been much more difficult. Misunderstanding and partial understanding may be quite helpful.
Say more about that. That's a big surprise. What does it do? It allows space to go to retreat and come back a second time and try again, or that you don't take it as personally because you're dealing with aliens and barbarians anyway, and so it's
yeah. The other person doesn't really understand you. I think there's In that gap, in that sort of a space of misunderstanding, you can hold on to your core beliefs and sort of believe that the other person understands them even when they don't. It's kind of this sort of a mutual dance that, you know, they are trying to pretend to understand and you don't. And like I said, you know, if the Spanish and the Comanches had really, really understood each other perfectly, I think it would have been more difficult for them to coexist. You know, it allows, you know, the misunderstandings allow the kind of the fiction that the world works as we want. And both sides can sort of maintain the fiction that they are in charge and the world functions as they want. Although much of the kind of a negotiation and supposed understanding are actually, you know, fictional and misunderstandings. That's the best I can do.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting and something to think about. I think there's not examples here. For example, the desecration of, for example, in one Comanche raid, you tell us how the statue of Saint Francis was toppled and beheaded, and so we see a lot of just violence that the Europeans would interpret as, you know, cruelty and barbarism, the scalping and gouging of eyes, or we said earlier the abuse of women, but then also to destroy the holy symbols. Mm-hmm. That's a sophisticated message. Like, we're not only going to kill the priests, we will also cut off the heads of the likeness of Saint Francis or something like that. I wonder. So I'll ask you a comparative question. And is this a bit like the Vikings of the 10th century, who, you know, they're not only they're swooping in to catch slaves and golden treasure and so on, but they also know that they're supposed to destroy the monastery. And so on. Is it feels more medieval, and maybe I feel that way because of the fairs, and maybe I'm putting too much of what I know onto something I don't know. But there is that negotiation through this language of violence that then allows, you know, projecting my understanding of what this alien group is onto them, and they can do the same to me. And that might be what you are just describing, which is.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, trade is a typical example of this because the Spanish believed that trade should be governed by markets, you know, the dynamics of supply and demand and prices. And Comanches believed that trade is sharing. And to share, you have to have a proper relationship, which is your relatives. You are relatives who share wealth with one another. So it's two diametrically different ideas about trade. And yet the Spanish and the Comanches trade extensively over a century or so, or nearly a century or so. And that there in that situation, that long-standing trading relationship it hinges on misunderstandings because they don't quite understand each other's meanings. So both are able to believe, the Spanish are able to believe that, you know, it is markets actually that run this system, and it's sort of just a neutral exchange that the Comanches are able to be, as long as the goods change hand, they are able to believe, frame the trade in terms of kinship, people becoming relatives who share wealth with one another. So that's one way to look at it. It's interesting you mentioned Vikings, you know, because when I was trying to understand the Comanche Empire and its sort of a geopolitical dimensions and how the Comanches, how on earth they were able to command so much space, you know, I did read a lot about the Vikings and the how the Vikings sort of like the Comanches were punching way above their demographic weight.
And then you get this this figure, if I may return to Velez Cachupin again, who understood that this is how these people understand trade, and this is how our people understand trade. And so if we make an agreement and put it on paper, it's going to be dead. But if we have to sit periodically and sit again, and every next time we see them, sit down again and smoke together. And so he was able to do that. And he was one example of a European who saw the Comanche as a nation, right? Give it that.
Absolutely. And he's performing, right? He's performing this role the Comanches expected him to play, and he did it beautifully.
So tell us, okay, so that's the 18th century. Tell us what happens in the 19th century. How does that, comes the United States?
It's interesting because the Comanche Empire, in my view, it really actually peaks in the early 19th century rather than starting to decline. I think the Comanches are at the height of their power in the 1830s and 40s, and that's largely because the Americans have now entered the picture. They are trading with the Comanches. They are coming, pushing westward, but not as really as soldiers, but rather as traders. And these people are wealthy, and they have technologies that the Spanish could never provide to the Comanches. They have their supply lines are superior, so they can inject a lot of wealth and technology into Comanche, allowing the Comanches to become ever increasingly powerful in the early 19th century, which is a really interesting dynamic. We have this American sort of behemoth expanding, American empire expanding westward, and the Comanches is becoming increasingly powerful, yet they don't really clash until late 19th century. So there's this really kind of almost mysterious coexistence between the two expanding powers.
One interesting development is the American-Mexican War that you also refer to. And when you study this from a Spanish point of view, a Spanish and Mexican point of view, it's obviously a war of aggression and snatching of territory because Polk wanted to, and because of manifest destiny, frankly, because the Americans could with very little cost. But also one thing that sometimes avoids the historical narrative, which I didn't discover until I was teaching this myself in a Mexican American history course, is that very, very few people lived up there who were Mexicans or Spanish people of Spanish ancestry who then became settlers of the New World. And so one thing I often tell my students is that, yes, this was about 50% of Mexican territory was taken in 1848, but only 1% of the Mexican population lived there. Having read your book, I wonder if that's not true, that there's tons of people there. They just don't happen to be counted by Mexican census takers. It's densely populated. It's just the whole story is the Comanche Empire and not this, this geographic fiction, this amazing expanse of land that changed hands at the stroke of a pen, but obviously on the ground nobody noticed for a while.
Absolutely. I'm sure a lot of people went unaccounted for. That's quite possible. Because, especially in the 1830s and 40s, the Comanches and also the Kiowas and Apaches, they are all over the map. And to a large extent, it's these three, indigenous powers that really dominate the landscape, not year-round, but seasonally, coming in, every summer, late spring, every summer, and raiding, for several months across the, multiple Mexican departments. So these are sort of exploited hinterlands or hinterlands of exploitation, systematic exploitation, where the state, the Mexican state, has very little presence, very little knowledge, and I would assume, wasn't able to sort of really use typical administrative tools, which include obviously counting and reporting and knowledge of what's going on, even just population numbers, they have been really hard to collect.
Yes, and I think you're constrained by that limitation of imperial administration, and much of the reporting you do about population is you're careful to say, here's our estimate and here's what we think, and perhaps in the boom times the population tripled from 10,000 to 30,000, and then there was a smallpox epidemic which you know knocked it back by half again, and so it seems to be very closely connected to politics, but also the land and also epidemics. But again, are we just guessing? Or how did you make these guesses? How did you?
You mean Comanche population?
Yes, Comanche population, yes. Or perhaps all populations. But
well, you know, the Mexican population, I didn't do much on Mexican population. But the Comanches, there are multiple. You know, the thing about is that the both the Spanish and the Mexican administrators, they wanted information, and they wanted to count. They absolutely needed to know how many natives there were, you know, especially Comanches. And there are quite a few censuses, and you just have to sort of compare them, you know, across one another. So I came to the figure about up to 40,000 Comanches at their peak in the late 18th century, which is about twice what other historians have estimated. Maybe it's controversial, but those are the figures. You know, I was satisfied, and there's not a whole lot, but I felt there was enough. There's enough to come up with the figure, which makes the Comanches, you know, one of the largest tribes or indigenous nations of the time.
Yes, and then also governs their political expansion, because when you have all these young people and young warriors who are too little to be in the last war, and they get to be of age and they want to demonstrate their strength and prowess and make a name for themselves, then it's time to go fight.
Yeah, and that is the sort of one of the kind of the social fuel of Comanche Empire. These young men needing to prove themselves as not only as warriors but also as providers and husbands. So there's a really interesting kind of social dynamic rather than strategic dynamic behind the Comanche expansion, especially into northern Mexico, where the potential of wealth, securing wealth was the greatest.
So another consequence that I found remarkable here is, and something anyone who studies early modern Spain thinks about, is the proselytization and Christianization of new peoples in the New World. One thing I learned from your book is that some of the Indians who became Christians were doing it to seek allies in the Spanish. For example, first the Apache, and then the Lipan, if I'm saying that correctly. They were persuaded by some friar with a beautiful picture of the Virgin or the Gospel. They said, like, we are really being pushed out of our lands by these fearsome Comanche. We need friends with guns. Let's convert to their religion and see how that works for us. Which is interesting too, because simultaneously the Spanish are coming up the Californian coast in the 1760s and 70s and trying to proselytize to Indians in California and not having much luck, and that's the story of the missions here. But again, it's much more political and interesting than one would get if you just read Spanish friars.
Isn't it? Yes. And again, we come back to performing, performance. I think the Apaches know exactly, you know, which, how to, what to tell the Spanish to get their support. And in many ways, I think they're manipulating the Spanish priest and Spanish officials, telling them exactly what they think they want to hear to get their support. And sort of appealing to their sensibilities and their ambitions and needs to secure protection. It's that sort of performance is really interesting in this world.
And I don't mean to imply that I think this is somehow unique to Indians, because I'm thinking of the Anders Windroth book about the Vikings, who were Christianizing to make allies with the French, or I'm thinking about the Archduke of Lithuania who becomes a Catholic so he can marry the Queen of Poland so that he can fight the, you know, the Teutonic Crusaders and so on. So I think this is not unusual. It's, I mean, maybe it is unusual, but it's so interesting because it's another comparative element to what's happening in this new world space that you brought to light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's actually, you know, probably, you know, one of the few sort of universal trends you can find almost everywhere where you have these different societies, indigenous, native, colonial, imperial, in the same space.
Okay, so you said that though the United States is expanding with the Louisiana Purchase and the idea of manifest destiny, they really come up against the Comanche toward the end of the 19th century. And so this is a time when Mexican land has fallen to the United States and the railroad is coming across. And what happens? How do we get from this Comanche empire, this Great Plains arrangement of polities, to what we know at the end of the 19th century, which is, you know, the American empire and the power of this industrial republic that stretches from sea to shining sea?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it perfectly. You know, we think that the United States happened to the Comanches, and it did, but that's not the sequence. You know, what happened to the Comanches was drought. In the you know, severe drought in the 1840s, and it was a prolonged drought, in very intense drought, and the buffalo populations collapsed, causing a massive widespread starvation among the Comanches. And at the same time, we had the Indian removal from the east to the Indian territory, and new diseases were spreading with the westward movement of all kinds of people, natives, American traders, and so forth. And Comanches, you know, being in a starving condition, could not resist. They became a sort of soft targets for smallpox and other crowd diseases, and the population just utterly collapses in a generation. Actually, in a few years, you know, it seems they go from about 20,000 to fewer than 10,000 in a very short time. So with that, the Comanche power just collapses, and after that, the Comanches are sort of become. They have to sort of turn inward and just trying to cope.
Which is at the same time that whole way of living and fighting is taken from them because of white settlers and farmers and railroads and destruction of the bison for all these reasons. Is that... That's simultaneous.
Yeah, that comes a little bit later. There's civil war actually allows the Comanches to kind of stage a bit of a comeback when it looks really bad in the late 1840s and in the 50s. But then the civil war erupts and the Comanches make a bit of a recovery. You know, the population sort of bounces back a little, and suddenly, you know, again, they had retreated really into the core of their land, you know, along the Arkansas River. But then they explode out again, and they're raiding all over the place in New Mexico, and especially in Texas, where the cattle industry had gotten off the ground. So it's a very dramatic comeback, but... it doesn't last.
And does that come to what is sort of those post-Civil War Indian Wars of the U.S. Cavalry that we know from cowboy movies?
They blend into those, yes. Yeah, exactly. And after Civil War, you know, United States has no patience with this kind of a raiding regime in its, in the core of its territory. So the United States just sort of implements this systematic sustained campaign of total war, where they target not only Comanches, but also their horses and the buffalo, and really trying to wipe out the economic foundation of the Comanche nation and the Comanche empire. And they do it swiftly with the help of the railroad and repeating rifles. So it's the final war is essentially an economic an act of economic warfare.
And this is a part of the history that we know from courses and from movies, and so this comes right back to the narrative that I'm familiar with. What is amazing is how little we know about the previous two centuries to that, and just from the arrival of the horse in the plains, which I think you put in the 17th century, I want to say.
It does in the 17th century, absolutely. Yeah.
The fact that these people came out of the Rockies and made for 200 years or near that amount such a powerful and dynamic empire, that until you wrote this, I think, at least as far as I can tell, being not a specialist, what was missing was entirely missing for the, and 200 years is a long time. It's there's a lot of empires that came and went in that amount of time.
Absolutely. And I'm just finishing now a new book, which is about the Lakota Sioux, another a formidable indigenous power, not unlike the Comanches. I make the case of for a Lakota empire as well in the northern plains, and but the same thing. And they are the most famous arguably of the native nations, but we only know really from Lewis and Clark till Little Bighorn, the 19th century story. And with the Lakotas, again, I go back to two and a half centuries, because, that story is really, we have, many wonderful specialist studies, but it hasn't really entered the American consciousness. It's just a forgotten history, and like you said, it's a long history and extremely interesting and dynamic and dramatic history of more than two centuries, which is which we know very little about.
How do the Lakota Sioux compare to the Comanche in power and size and strategy and so on?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I think they are in some ways very similar, but the main axis with the Lakotas is from east to west, so they are kind of paralleling the U.S. expansion to some extent, and the geography is much more complicated. They are engaging with multiple colonial powers, because you have the French, you have the Spanish in the south, you have the Americans, you have the British, you have multiple wars they are involved in. But the Comanche case was sort of more clear-cut in a way. You had the Spanish and then the Mexican colonies to the south, which were, sort of a soft target. And then the Comanches traded to the north and east, and it was kind of a two-faced system, very simple system, if you will, and in some ways the Lakota story is more complicated and also involves much larger cast of protagonists.
Well, that's wonderful. And what is that book going to be called, and when is it coming out?
It's coming out in the spring of 19. So as of now, the title is Iktomi's People, the Lakota Age in America. And Iktomi is the cultural hero of the Lakota Indians. It's a sort of a shape-shifting spider character. And one of the key themes of the book is the kind of shape-shifting ability of the Lakota people, which really allows them to be a dominant power in the American interior for over two centuries, almost three centuries, because they're so adaptable and so, wonderfully capable of adjusting to different governing conditions, shifting shape politically, socially, culturally, mentally. You have it. You name it.
That would be great. Perhaps we could do this again in a year when we've all read Iktomi's People.
Very happy.
So let me ask you, this this book is quite influential for history faculties at universities. How has it been received among American Indians, and what is the Comanche state? What is the state of the Comanche people in 2018, and how has your work been received, or has it been received, or what do you know about it?
Yeah, no, I've met with quite a few Comanches and Comanche people, and you know, one is always nervous. You know, you don't really know, you know, what people how the objects of your study react to the book. But they, my understanding is it's one of the key textbooks in the Comanche Tribal College, and they appreciate the book. Is my understanding, and they are quite happy with it, because it really, you know, what I've heard, you know, what they appreciated is it's an honest kind of take on things, you know, genuine attempt to try to understand how the society worked, but also sort of restoring the agency and of Native people, of the Comanche people, by showing, you know, on what scale, you know, on this massive scale, they could sort of command the world and shape history over such a long time. So that kind of restoring the indigenous agency and indigenous capacity to survive and shape things was, I think, quite appreciated or quite welcome.
I think we live in a time when we talk about where we still have these group identities and we think about our nations, and you know, I'm an immigrant to the United States from Poland, so I'm pretty aware of a golden age in the Polish history, say in the 16th century, and I imagine every little Indian boy and girl would like to hear about the golden age of their people, and so for every other group, and that's part of, I think, the storytelling we tell, even though we live in this multi-ethnic, multinational world, the global West, and so on. So
it's sort of an anchor into your past, and you know, as such, becomes a central part of your modern identity. Exactly.
Yeah, it certainly helps the conversation, and I personally greatly enjoy the comparative aspects, which, you know, sometimes we can get carried away with, I think, as historians, because we like to see what we see. But what is it that I have not asked you today that we should talk about? Is there any other important?
I don't know. I mean, this is exactly the arc I expected. So it's been just wonderful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Pekka Hämäläinen. It is a great pleasure and an honor to speak with you, and I enjoyed your book so much, and I'm looking forward to the next one, Iktomi's People, in the spring of 2019.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.